of the two Macintosh computers on the long table at the back of the room. She especially loved Mr. Hanna because he had worked at the New York Times, the Atlanta Constitution, and the L.A. Times, all before pissing off so many people that the only place left to spout off his big mouth was inside the halls of academia. "Tenure," he often told them, "is the last bastion of free speech." Despite his scraggly, unkempt appearance, Mr. Hanna had done pretty well by moving to Athens. UGA's Grady College of Journalism was nationally renowned, which was fantastic if you were a parent who didn't want to pay out-of-state tuition, and horrible if you were an aspiring journalism student who wanted to live somewhere other than the town in which you grew up. Mr. Hanna smiled when Julia walked into the room. "There's my pretty girl." Somehow, he made the word seem like a gesture of affection rather than a creepy come-on. "Where is my riveting piece on the coming privatization of the cafeteria's meal services?" Julia handed him her article. He scanned it while she stood there, the overhead light reflecting her typed words back onto the lenses of his eyeglasses. "It works," he said, which was the best any of them could ever hope for. "What else you got for me? I need some news."
"I was thinking," Julia began, even as she felt the opening line she had so deftly crafted just moments ago slip out of her brain and float into the ether.
"A girl, a beautiful girl, was..." "And..." Mr. Hanna clapped together his hands.
"And?"
"And..." Julia's skull was an empty, brainless Tupperware bowl. She was vibrating with anxiety. She felt like she was going to burst into tears.
"Julia?"
"Yes." She cleared her throat. Her tongue had turned into a bag of wet salt. She went to the facts, because the facts mattered. "There was a girl who disappeared. She lived, about 15 minutes from here."
"And?"
"Well, she's gone. Abducted. The detective on the case said..."
"Probably ran off with a boyfriend,"
someone interrupted. Julia looked over Mr. Hanna's shoulder. Greg Giannakos, Lionel Vance, Budgie Green. Their heads stuck up above the production partition like prairie dogs. They all had cigarettes dangling from their mouths, and all were on their way to becoming as flabby and bleary-eyed as their mentor. The only difference was that they looked at her with a marked absence of Mr. Hanna's kindness.
"Ignore them, kid," Mr. Hanna coaxed. "Pitch me a story I can put on the front page."
"Okay," Julia said, like it was that easy to recapture her earlier certainty. What was the heart of the Beatrice Oliver story? What was the hook? Julia thought about the terror that had gripped her when she first read about the girl's abduction on the telex. The menace she had felt this morning when she walked down streets that were as familiar as her childhood home. The fear summoned by the article she'd read in her mother's kitchen. She had to distill for Mr. Hanna what really bothered her about the Beatrice Oliver abduction. It wasn't just that the girl was snatched off the street. It wasn't just that she was being kept. It was why she had been taken in the first place. She told Mr. Hanna, "Rape."
"Rape?"
He was obviously surprised.
"What about it?"
"She was raped," Julia said, because why else would a man abduct a woman less than 2 blocks away from her family home? Why else would he keep her?
"Are you talking about Jenny Loudermilk?"
Greg Giannakos stood up from his desk. He crossed his arms over his broad chest.
"No way you can squeeze more than a paragraph out of that."
Julia shrugged, but only because she had no idea who Jenny Loudermilk was. Apparently, neither did Mr. Hanna.
"Fill me in."
"Sophomore," Greg said,
though Mr. Hannah had directed his request to Julia. Good-looking blonde, wrong place, wrong time.
Lionel Vance took over.
I heard she was pretty sloppy, spent most of the night looking for the bottom of a PBR.
Yeah, everybody knows sophomores are cheap drunks.
Greg was clearly annoyed at having a story stepped on. Anyway, the gal was pouring her way down Broad Street, and some guy grabbed her, took her into an alley, and raped her.
Mr. Hannah patted his pockets for his cigarettes. Nobody wants to read about rape. Say, assaulted or attacked or threatened if she wasn't hit.
He asked Julia.
That's the story you want to tell?
Well, I...
She won't talk to you, Lionel said. The victim, they never talk, so what's your story? Some girl gets drunk and goes off with the wrong guy? Like Greg said, that's barely a paragraph. I wouldn't even put it on the back page.
Mr. Hannah lit his cigarette. He asked Julia,
"You agree? Disagree?"
I think
it's an anomaly, Greg interrupted. If your story is that suddenly the world is filled with rapists, you're wrong. And a university campus is statistically one of the safest places to be.
Mr. Hannah blew out a stream of smoke.
Statistics, huh? Greg said, "Look, Jules, don't let your emotions cloud your judgment. Yes, what happened to Jenny shouldn't have happened, but a reporter only reports the facts. And you won't get any facts here, because the victim already scurried off home. The guy who did it certainly won't talk, and the cops won't discuss a case that's never going to be prosecuted."
Julia's fingernails dug into her palms. She thought about the stack of printouts in her purse. She wanted to throw them in Greg's smug face, but they would only prove his point. 28 women in a state with a population of almost 6.5 million was hardly a significant number. He seemed to read her mind.
Jenny Loudermilk was one girl out of approximately 15,000 female students. That's an outlier.
Julia tried. It doesn't always get reported.
Because half of them got drunk and changed their minds.
I meant reported in the newspaper. She remembered that the articles were about missing women, not women who had been raped, assaulted, attacked. Or reported to the police, or reported to anybody.
For good reason. Greg lit a cigarette. This is the story. That the campus is safer for women than it's ever been. That the world is safer for women than it's ever been. Is that right?
Mr. Hannah crossed his arms over his chest. He was grinning like a maniac.
Back that up, hotshot. Give me your statistical proof that the world is safer for women, other than because it looks great through your Wonderbread Viewmaster. I will.
Greg went to one of the Macintoshes at the back of the room. He turned on the machine and sat down.
We've got all the crime statistics from the last 10 years on a set of disks. I'm gonna die of old age by the time that thing boots up.
Mr. Hannah stood at the metal shelves behind his desk. He traced his finger along the spines of several books until he found what he was looking for.
The FBI is mandated by the United States Congress to collect all relevant crime data from a set number of police forces around the country at least once every year.
He plucked out several books.
1989 is the most current report I've got.
He handed one of the volumes to Julia.
Budgie, Mr. Hannah called to the only boy who hadn't joined the fray. We need a non-English major for our computations. Get thee to the chalkboard. Julia?
He gave Julia a nod.
Population of the United States in 1989?
She cracked open the book and thumbed through the index. She found the page number, then the correct page, and read, 252,153,092.
Half that, Budgie. Men don't count in this equation. It's not half, Budgie said. Women are slightly less than 51% of the population. L'chaim. Mr. Hanna tapped his cigarette ash into a styrofoam cup. But half whatever you get from your 51% because they don't collect data below the age of consent.
Julia thought she'd heard wrong. She looked down at the book in her lap and ran her finger down to the methodology. Forcible rape includes assaults or attempts to commit rape by force or threat of force. However, statutory rape, without force, and other sex offenses are excluded.
You should have that number a third time, Greg said. At least that many women have buyer's remorse.
Whoa there! Mr. Hanna held up his hand like a referee calling a foul. No conjecture allowed. Let's stick to the data, he instructed Julia. So, in your story, you'll say, extrapolating from the FBI's uniform crime reports, blah, 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 right?
Julia nodded, but this had stopped being her story a while ago.
Mr. Hanna asked, number of reported assaults in 1989, Julia?
Oh, sorry. Julia looked for the correct column. Forcible rapes, 106,593.
106,593, Mr. Hanna repeated, making sure Budgie got the number right. That's probably pretty consistent across the last 5 years, but we'll need to verify that.
Julia stared at the board, boggled by the figure. The population of Athens-Clark County was less than 100,000. The statistic was greater than every single person in town. Man, woman, and child.
Come on, Budgie, work the chalk. Mr. Hanna clapped his hands to get Budgie moving. Round up, son, we don't have all day.
Julia checked the data a second time, certain she'd seen it wrong. There it was. 106,593. She stared at the numbers until they blurred. Over 100,000 women. And that was just the ones who were over the age of consent,
and had actually reported the crime, and had been threatened with violence.
What were the other sex offenses that didn't count?
What about the women who didn't go to the police?
Why did the crime only make the newspapers if the girl wasn't around to tell her story?
Got it. Budgie underlined the number so many times that the chalk broke in two. At the current levels, women in the United States have a 0.0434% chance of being assaulted. That's around 43 per thousand.
Mr. Hanna was as familiar with the population number of Athens as Julia was. He summed up.
So, transferring that number to our own fair city, that's roughly 22 women a year, which is around one assault every 2.5 weeks.
Julia closed the book. Were Beatrice Oliver and Mona No Name two victims for the list? Jenny Loudermilk made 3.
Setting aside that it was already March, and there were probably others, that left at least 19 more Athens women who would be raped before 1992 rolled in.
And then the clock would reset, and the countdown would start all over.
Greg spiked his cigarette into a Coke can. Less than half of 1% seems pretty rare to me.
He crossed his arms over his chest.
You'd have a better chance getting struck by lightning or winning the lottery.
Budgie laughed.
You sure about that, Einstein?
Figure speech.
Greg waved away the sarcasm, asking Julia,
why did you want to do this story again? That's like 100,000 people out of almost 300 million. A drop in the bucket. Nobody cares about that. It's not news.
Julia wasn't given time to answer.
What about murder?
Lionel took the book from Julia.
Let's do murder. I want to know my chances. Pretty high if your parents find out you're failing trig.
Budgie grabbed the chalk.
Okay, population goes back up to 200,500,000.
AIDS, Julia said. They all turned to look at her.
You said
It didn't matter because it's only 100,000 people. She willed her voice to remain steady. Around the same number of U.S. AIDS cases were diagnosed in 1989, but the stories on the cover of Time, Newsweek, every newspaper in the country has some kind of story every day, and the president gives speeches about it. Congress does hearings. The Americans with Disability Act ensures people can't lie about having AIDS, Greg interrupted. Julia felt a bolt of fire pass through her body. If you want to speculate, then speculate that the handful of liars are more than canceled out by all the women who never come forward, or the women who are underage, or the women who weren't beaten during... The Surgeon General of the United States has called AIDS an epidemic. Greg's tone was infuriatingly pedantic. And you don't say diagnosed with AIDS, you say diagnosed with HIV, the virus that causes AIDS. Julia mumbled a rare curse under her breath. Greg pretended not to hear. And also, people die from AIDS. Women don't die from assault. Lionel said, "Why do their vaginas do?" "Hey," Budgie threw the eraser at his head, "don't be an asshole." Mr. Hanna asked Julia, "What's the lead?" She didn't have to think about it this time. "Something horrible happens to at least 100,000 American women every single year, and no one seems to care about it." Greg snorted, "I'm sure Cosmo is all over it." Mr. Hanna made a swipe of his hand to shut him up. He told Julia, "Keep boiling it down." In news reporting, when something bad happens predominantly to males, it's an epidemic worth national attention. But when something bad happens to women... Oh, come on, Greg groaned. Why does it always have to come down to how shitty men are? It's not... We get it, Greg said. You're a feminist. I didn't. You hate us because we have dicks. Stop interrupting me! The sound of Julia's fist slamming against the desk echoed like a gunshot. I don't hate you because you have a dick. I hate you because you are a dick. The room went utterly and completely silent. Julia took a stuttered breath, as if she'd just poked her head up above the water. Oh, burn. Lionel punched Greg in the arm. Score one for the Ice Queen. She didn't, Greg said. It's not. Julia spun on her heel and headed toward the door. Her hands were shaking. She felt trembly and annoyed and, underneath, slightly proud of herself because what a fantastic parting shot. Hey, Mr. Hanna caught up with her in the hallway. Julia turned around. I'm sorry, I... Good reporters never apologize. Oh, she said, because nothing more cogent came to mind. I want the draft of that story on my desk by 10 Friday morning. Julia's mouth opened. Nothing came out. She had stopped breathing again. She needed to breathe. That doable? Yes, she said. I also haven't, I mean, I can... Put it in your article, 1,200 words. 1,200 is the... Front page. He winked at her. You got this, kid. She watched him cut through the thick smoke as he returned to the bullpen. The front page. Panic set in the moment she started walking down the hallway. Julia put her fingers to her neck. Her pulse was ticking like a bomb. Her vision tunneled to the light coming through the glass doors 30 yards away. Mr. Hanna said that she had it, but what exactly did she have? Beatrice Oliver's story wasn't tied up in this new one. Not really. Beatrice was gone. She had probably been abducted. The detective had said as much. But anything past that was speculation. Ditto for the printouts in Julia's purse about the 28 missing women. They had vanished. That's all anyone could say about them. They were young, they were beautiful, they were striking, and they were gone.
How was that news?
Jesus, she mumbled. It wasn't news. At least, not enough news. This was what Julia got for running her mouth without thinking. She had been so flustered and so angry and so tired of being talked over and dismissed, and Greg had taken a stray comment and goat-roped her into a loaded political commentary when all Julia was really saying was that it was a story when something, anything, happened to 100,000 people every single year. But why in the hell had she said that AIDS only affected men when Delilah was a perfect contradiction? She hadn't said it only affected men. She'd said it predominantly affected men. And she hadn't said it was worse than AIDS. She'd said that it was awful on its own without any other comparisons, and that no one wanted to write about it. No one even wanted to call it what it really was. Assaulted, attacked, threatened. No wonder Jenny Loudermilk had left town. How could any woman talk about something horrible that had happened to her if she wasn't even allowed to call it by its real name? That was the story. A crime without a name. Victims without a voice. Julia pulled a notepad and pen out of her book bag. She needed to write some of this down before she forgot it.
What's poppin', soda?
She almost dropped her pen. Robin was leaning against the wall. His hands were in his pockets. He was wearing a flannel shirt and acid-washed jeans, and his hair was a mess. Julia felt a silly grin break across her face. I thought you were camping this week.
My little sister forgot her asthma inhaler.
He grinned back.
She's got enough to last until tonight.
That's nice. I mean, nice that you got it for her.
I haven't been by the house yet.
He leaned down, letting his forehead touch hers.
I was hoping I would run into you.
Her heart flopped in her chest. How did you know I was here?
I asked around.
Oh.
You look pretty.
She should have combed her hair, and brushed her teeth, and worn something nicer, and lost 5 pounds. Damn her stupid grandmother.
Look.
Robin held her hand like he was admiring a piece of china.
I don't know if this is the right thing or wrong thing to say, but my entire family is out in the woods right now, and the house is empty. And they don't expect me back for at least another 2 hours. And I'd really like to spend some time alone with you.
She nodded. And then her heart flopped again when she realized why it mattered that his parents' house was empty and he had 2 hours to fill. He touched his nose to hers.
Does that sound like a good idea?
Julia was speechless again for all the wrong reasons. This morning, she'd been so certain that she was ready for this, but now, she felt the early tremors of an anxiety attack. Could she really do this? Should she really do this? Would Robin still want to be with her if she gave in to him? And could she call it giving in to him if it was something she wanted too? Because she wanted it. Even underneath her panic, she knew that she wanted it. So did that mean she was a bad girl, or a liberated woman, or a prick tease, or a slut? This was so much more than sex. It was about whether she did too much or didn't do enough, or knew how things worked or didn't know what went where. Okay, that was crazy. Of course she knew the basics, the what goes where, but there were other things to do, to use, to touch or put in your mouth or to lick or bite. Or was her sister just lying about that because it sounded painful? and the fact was that Julia was 19 years old and she had no idea what she was doing. For the love of God, she hid her birth control pills inside a shoe at the back of her closet because she didn't want Nancy Griggs to tell everyone that she was loose. Robin asked,
"You okay?"
Julia pressed his hand over her heart, which was pounding out a nagging drumbeat of terror because, even on the pill, she could get pregnant. And even with a condom, she might catch something horrible, and her life would be over and she would never see her name under the Atlanta Journal masthead or be able to report on camera for a devastating tornado. So why the hell would she take such an extraordinarily idiotic risk in the first place?
"It's okay."
Robin gave her a crooked half-smile.
"Seriously, if you don't want to."
"Yes," she said. "I want to." 4:20 p.m. Outside the Tate Student Center, University of Georgia, Athens. Julia's fingers were still trembling when she dropped a quarter into the payphone. Her mouth felt bruised from Robin's kisses. Her breasts tingled. She could still feel him inside of her. She felt like there was a big neon sign over her head that read, "Julia Carroll, loved." She wanted to sing. She wanted to dance. She wanted to stand in the middle of the quad and toss her hat high into the air. Pepper answered the phone on the second ring.
"Carroll residence."
"Hey, it's me."
"Oh, God, I'm so glad you called." Pepper's voice became muffled. "Can you still hear me?"
Julia glanced around as if someone might be listening. "What is it?"
"The brat got detention."
Julia momentarily forgot about Robin. "Are you lying?"
"No, she's fine, but Angie Wexler tried to jump her in the hall after school."
Julia put her hand to her mouth.
"Poor sweet pea." "Don't feel sorry for her," Pepper said. "Mom and Dad aren't even going to punish her."
Julia felt her sympathy drain away. She told them it was because she wouldn't let Angie cheat off her chemistry lab, but what really happened is that Angie caught the brat making out with her brother, who is 17 years old and has a car. Julia was so glad that she finally had more experience with boys than her stupid baby sister. "Is she okay?"
"She's acting all sad so that Mom and Dad will feel sorry for her, but they're still going to Harry Bissett's tonight."
"I thought Mom said the waiters were too ironic."
"It's Athens. Everybody's too ironic. Why did you call?"
Julia picked at a strip of peeling paint on the payphone. There was a lump in her throat. She blinked away the sudden tears that had come into her eyes. Why was she crying?
"Are you okay?"
"Of course." Julia wiped her eyes. "Tell me about your day." Pepper launched into a litany of complaints about their parents, their sister, her teachers at school. Julia stared up at the cloudless blue sky. She had called to tell Pepper about Robin, but now she wasn't sure that she was ready to share. What had happened between them was special, and romantic, and beautiful, and pleasurable. She was pretty sure she'd orgasmed, but gossiping about it seemed wrong, especially on a payphone. She would tell Pepper next month, after it had happened more than once. And when she was sure she'd orgasmed. She would mention it casually, like, "Oh, that? Of course we've done that."
"Anyway," Pepper said, "that freaky girl with the googly eyes is coming over to study with the brat. I'll probably go practice with the band."
"I'll probably be at the Manhattan," Julia said, because Robin had told her that he might be able to sneak off tonight after his parents went to sleep. There was a payphone near the ranger station. He would page Julia with 3 ones if he could make it, and 3 twos if he couldn't. The thought of waiting around her dorm room for her pager to beep was excruciating.
Hey, space cadet, you there?
Pepper sounded exasperated.
I asked if you borrowed my bangles.
Julia lifted her wrist. The silver and black bangles slid down her arm.
Check the brat's room.
I'll do it later. She's really upset.
Pepper lowered her voice again. And you better believe I'm going to stop by Angie Wexler's house tonight and scare the shit out of that little snot-nosed bitch and her stupid pedophile brother.
Good. Julia leaned her head against the wall. Pepper was so much better at intimidating people. Julia much preferred to stay in the background and cheer people on.
Hey, do you ever wonder what's going to happen to us when we're old?
Pepper barked a surprised laugh. Where did that come from?
Julia knew where it had come from. Being held by Robin, seeing the way he looked at her, listening to him talk about how he liked working at the bakery, and maybe if his art career didn't take off, he could see himself working with his dad, maybe one day teaching his own son the business. His own son. Julia could give him that. She wanted to give him that. She told Pepper,
like, 20 years from now, what are our lives going to be like?
Talking about hemorrhoids and trading tips on how to keep our dentures clean?
Do the math, dipshit. We'll be Mom's age.
Mom wears orthopedic shoes.
Julia groaned. She was right. But they were too cool to get old like that.
Pepper said, you'll be married to a great guy who loves you, and I'll be divorced from an asshole who left me when his music career took off.
Julia smiled, because Pepper might be right. The brat will be married to some computer geek who worships the ground she walks on and has at least $500,000 in the bank.
She'll probably cheat on him with my asshole ex.
You could be the asshole who leaves her husband when her music career takes off.
Maybe. Pepper said, but she didn't sound convinced.
Listen, Julia glanced around again to make sure no one could hear her. About the coke.
I know.
She didn't know. Julia had seen it happen, first to a friend in high school, then to a junior who dropped out of college. It can go from being fun to being a problem really fast. Don't worry.
We've got a top-flight homeless shelter in town.
Lydia.
Pepper was quiet. No one ever called her by her real name. I'd better go. I told Her Highness I would bring her some cocoa.
Kiss her for me.
Pepper made a smacking sound before she hung up. Julia left her hand on the receiver long after she'd hung up the phone. Pepper liked cocaine. She had used it twice since that fateful party. She liked pills. She liked being with the band. She liked checking out and floating into the oblivion. And she especially liked it when there was a cute guy around. It wouldn't be a problem, though. Julia would make sure of that. Her sister was a free spirit. She was going through a phase, like when Julia refused to wear anything that was orange, or when the brat would only eat sweet peas. Julia closed her eyes and let a vision wash over her. Sitting on the back porch of the Boulevard house, Pepper and Sweet Pea playing cards on the steps. Her parents in their rocking chairs. Children running in the yard. Their children. Pepper, Julia, even the brat, who would have one perfect golden child who ended up curing cancer shortly after refusing a third term as president of the United States. Julia wanted her children to be close to her sister's children. She wanted them to feel the same connection she felt with her family, the same safety, the same love. Nothing bad happened to people who were connected to their families. Maybe that had been Beatrice Oliver's problem. The first telex story had reported that the missing girl was an only child. Wouldn't it have been different if she'd had sisters?
Wouldn't a sister have gone with Beatrice to get ice cream and complain about what happened at school that day? Wouldn't a baby sister have pitched a fit so she could tag along, too? Julia could only imagine Beatrice's mother's sleepless nights as she ran through the if-onlys. If only I had gone to the store instead. If only I had driven her. If only we'd had more children, so that the loss of one would be mitigated by the presence of the others. Could that kind of loss be mitigated, though? Julia couldn't imagine what it was like to lose a child. The loss of a beloved pet, even a gerbil or ferret, brought her entire family, including her mother, to their knees. They would cry in front of the TV, sob at the dinner table, mourn as they cuddled all of the remaining dogs and cats and various creatures around themselves in a big furry blanket. No one would mourn the loss of Mona No Name. No one but Julia, whose imagination would not stop running wild. Was Mona being kept like Beatrice Oliver? Or maybe Mona's situation was more like Jenny Loudermilk's, the girl who'd decided, after being attacked, that it was easier to just disappear. No matter what, didn't part of a girl automatically disappear when something bad like that happened? Didn't a rapist take away the girl, the woman she was going to be, and replace her with someone who was afraid for the rest of her life? Even if Beatrice Oliver was freed, even if she was still alive, how could she go back home after being raped? How would she be able to look her father in the eye? How could she not wince for the rest of her life every time a man, even a good man, looked at her? Julia wiped underneath her eyes with the tips of her fingers. Maybe Greg Giannakos was right about letting your emotions get in the way of a story. She found her bicycle still chained to the rack, but she couldn't jam the stupid key into the rusted lock. Julia shoved her hands into her pockets and trudged back toward her dorm. The grounds crew was working on a section of lawn that had been destroyed by a group of rugby players. Julia gave the men a wide berth, holding her breath as the smell of fertilizer filled her nostrils. She tried to map out the rest of her night. She should take a sleeping bag to the library. She had to study for her psych exam. She needed to redo her Spencer paper. She needed to find some more statistics for her story. Her front page story. God, what had she gotten herself into? A draft by Friday? She'd be lucky if she had an outline. "You going back?" Nancy asked. She had come out of nowhere. She laughed when she saw Julia startle. "It's just me, silly." "Let's go out tonight." Worrying about everything tomorrow sounded like a really good idea. "I heard Michael Stipe is going to be at the Manhattan." Nancy's eyes narrowed. "I heard he was supposed to be at the Grit. Or was it the Georgia Bar?" "We can still have fun. Maybe meet some cute guys, get them to buy us some drinks." Nancy bumped Julia's hip. "I thought you already had a cute guy." Julia smiled and blushed and felt relieved because she could tell that the tension between them was over. "Let's get a group together. It'll be fun." "I don't know. I need to study." "We'll go to the library. Then we'll get something to eat, then we'll meet everybody around 9:30 tonight." The time wasn't completely random. Robin had promised he would call her pager by 10. 3-2s would mean that he couldn't sneak away. In which case, it would be nice to be at a noisy bar where she could drink and dance away her crushing disappointment. And if he sent 3-1s, then she would be closer to his parents' house, which would still be vacant, and would be vacant for the rest of the night. "What do you say?" Julia asked, because most of her friends were really Nancy's friends. "Sounds fun, right?" Nancy smiled. "Sounds awesome." 9:46 p.m. The Manhattan Cafe, downtown Athens, Georgia. Julia loved dancing, mostly because she was terrible at it. People stopped to watch. They looked at her not because she was attractive, but because she was making a fool of herself. As her father said about almost every one of her previous boyfriends, it was hard to dislike a fool. "Did you see Top Gun?" Nancy nodded toward a lesser Tom Cruise standing at the bar. Julia squinted her eyes to see through the thick layer of cigarette smoke. The man wore a bomber jacket and sunglasses, even though it was warm and he was inside. "Foxy," Julia said, trying to keep as much of the beat as she could. Her dancing was never enhanced by trying to carry on a conversation. The floor was packed. People kept bumping into her, or maybe she was the one who kept bumping into them. After getting elbowed in the ribs, she finally gave up and nodded for Nancy to follow her to the bathroom. The line was packed with students, most of them underage. Julia recognized the snippy girl from this morning who'd borrowed Nancy's leather satchel and insulted Julia's socks. Alabama was clearly out of it. She was swaying back and forth, catching herself at the last second before she fell flat on her face. No one was helping her. Maybe she'd insulted their socks, too. "Jesus," Nancy said, "have some dignity." Julia had to raise her voice over the music. "Do you know her?" "Deanie Crowder." Julia rolled her eyes in a way that indicated she wished that she didn't.
"I hope she's got somebody to take her home."
Julia felt her strident voice start to simmer in the back of her throat. "Why do you keep looking at your watch?" Julia looked up from her watch.
"No reason. Just feels later than it is."
She had her pager on vibrate, but still checked it.
"Who's supposed to call?"
"Sorry. My little sister got in trouble today."
"The golden child?"
"She's not so bad."
Julia clipped the pager back on the inside of her pocket. She should have called Sweet Pea to check in on her. And she should have been firmer with Pepper about the drugs. She was the big sister. It was her job to look out for them. She would find time for both of them this weekend. Maybe take Sweet Pea to Wuxtry to buy an album. She really wasn't that bad once you got her alone.
"Move!" somebody called from the back of the line.
They inched closer to the bathroom. Julia saw herself in a floor-length mirror. She was wearing one of Robin's shirts. He'd pulled it out of the laundry basket for her. She put her hand to her neck and found Pepper's locket. The silver and black bangles fell down her arm. She would give the locket back this weekend. And the bangles. And the straw hat. Because it was Pepper's anyway.
"You look great," Nancy said.
"No, wait.
You look beautiful."
Julia laughed. She was imitating the goofy guy at the taco stand who flirted with every girl who walked through the door. Nancy asked, "How about me?"
"You look beautiful, too."
Nancy actually looked pretty good. She had chosen to go Cyndi Lauper to Julia's Madonna. Her dark hair was spiked up. She wore a multicolored bolero jacket with gold trim. Her black crinoline skirt flared out just above her knee. Her spiky leather boots would be killing her feet by now, but the look was worth it.
"Mascara?" Nancy asked.
Julia studied the skin around her eyes, looking for smears.
"Nope. Me?"
"Marvelous."
She drawled a perfect Billy Crystal. The line finally moved, and Julia went into the first stall. She felt her pager vibrate as she started to unbutton her jeans. She didn't scroll the number right away. She sat down on the toilet. She looked up at the ceiling. She looked at the posters taped to the back of the stall door. She finally looked down at the pager. She pressed the button to scroll the number. 222. Her heart broke into a million pieces. 2-2-2. Julia looked up, trying to keep her tears from falling. She sniffed. She counted to a slow 100. She looked down again because maybe she was wrong. 2-2-2. Robin couldn't get away from his parents. Or maybe he could get away, but he didn't want to. Maybe Julia had been awful this afternoon. Maybe she was boring. Maybe Robin knew she hadn't orgasmed, or she had orgasmed too loudly, or breathed too hard, or sounded too silly, or... God! Somebody groaned. Julia heard the distinctive sound of vomit hitting toilet water. It had to be Alabama, a.k.a. Deanie Crowder. The sound of her retching was like a duck being sucked through a tuba. Nancy dry-heaved. She had been a sympathetic vomiter since an ill-fated pilgrim's feast in kindergarten. Julia heard her stiletto boots snapping against the concrete as she rushed out of the bathroom. Instead of going after her, Julia leaned back against the toilet tank. She held the pager in her hand, praying it would vibrate again, that she would press the button and see 111. Yes, I can get away. Please meet me at my parents' house because I love you. Robin hadn't actually said that he loved her. Was she a fool for being with him like that when he hadn't even told her that, above everyone else, it was Julia who had his heart? Someone banged on the stall door.
Lady's got a pee out here.
Julia flushed the toilet. She stood up. She pushed open the door. She washed her hands. She went back to the bar and stood close enough to Top Gun for him to get the message.
Buy you a drink?
Up close, he was more of a goose, but Julia was past caring about that kind of thing. She smiled sweetly. I love those Moscow mules. She didn't, actually, but the vodka, ginger ale, and lime cocktail cost $4.50, and that was a more expedient way to get drunk than the dollar PBRs they drank when they had to pick up their own tabs.
I like the way you dance,
Top Gun told her. Julia threw back the drink. Let's go. He followed her onto the dance floor, where he proved to be an even worse dancer than Julia. He shuffled side to side. He kept his elbows bent, his fingers snapping. Sometimes he looked down and over his shoulder, an approximation of a man making sure he hadn't stepped in dog shit. At least Julia put her heart into it, throwing out her arms, wiggling her hips when CNC Music Factory told everybody to dance now. Top Gun dropped away when Lisa Lisa came on. Head to toe. Julia closed her eyes and tried not to think about Robin. She didn't know if he liked dancing. Maybe he didn't even like Madonna. Maybe he'd just said that to get into her pants. Or maybe he'd said it because he really loved her. Why would he talk about having a son working at his father's bakery if he wasn't thinking about his future? Or maybe he was thinking about his future without her. Julia couldn't be around all these people anymore. The crush of the dance floor was too much. She pushed her way through the crowd. She found her purse hooked on the bar stool where she'd left it. She rummaged past her toothbrush and hairbrush and toiletries and change of underwear that she'd packed in anticipation of not going back to her dorm that night. Her lip gloss felt cold on her lips because she was sweating and it was hot in the bar. Some older guy had bought her a second Moscow Mule. The ice had melted. The liquid had turned from gold to tan. She drank it anyway. The vodka hit the back of her throat like a hammer.
Whoa there!
Nancy patted her back until Julia stopped coughing.
You okay?
What time is it? Nancy checked Julia's watch.
Exactly 10:38 in the evening.
She'd been dancing for less than an hour. It had felt like an eternity. I want to go back.
Why don't you wait until 11 and we'll go together?
No, my head is killing me. Julia put her hand to her head
which actually did hurt. Nancy said, "You were the one who said we shouldn't go out alone."
"Only if we're drunk, and I'm not drunk."
Actually, Julia felt a bit lightheaded, but that was probably because her broken heart was sitting at the bottom of her stomach.
"Thanks for coming out tonight. It really meant a lot. I'm sorry Michael Stipe didn't show up."
"I didn't really think he would." Nancy looked at her like she was acting weird. Maybe she was.
"Sure you're okay," Julia said. "I love you, buddy. You're a good friend."
"Aw." Nancy rubbed her back again.
"I love you too, buddy."
Julia unhooked her purse from the back of the chair. The floor was still crowded with dancers and lingerers, and students who would regret their indulgences when their alarms went off in the morning. Thank God Julia didn't have any classes tomorrow. She would go home to her room in the Boulevard House and sulk around in her pajamas and cuddle all the cats and dogs around her and watch soap operas all day. She pushed open the heavy metal door. The night air was the most welcome feeling that Julia had ever experienced. With every step, she felt her lungs open up like petals on a flower. Her head spun from all the fresh oxygen. She held out her arms as she walked down the empty sidewalk, embracing the night, embracing the clarity it brought. As her grandmother might say, Julia needed to get a hold of herself. Robin Clark was sweet and kind and gentle and wonderful, and she loved being with him and might even be in love with him, but he was not the sole reason her world turned on its axis. Julia was 19 years old. She was going to write her first front-page story. She was going to graduate at the top of her class from one of the best journalism schools in the country. She had good health. She had good friends. She had a loving family. Instead of being some silly teenager whose heart rose and fell depending on how a boy felt, or might feel about her, she needed to act like a grown woman and look at the facts. Robin had called her pager to tell her he couldn't come. If he was writing Julia off, if he had just used her for sex, then he wouldn't bother to sneak to the ranger station and risk his family's wrath. Right? Because Julia knew that Robin's father took this camping thing very seriously. It was an annual affair. He closed down the bakery the first week of every March. He took his entire family into the woods so he could spend time with them. And Robin was honoring that. He was a good guy. He was like Julia's father, and Mr. Hanna, and David Conford, and her Grandpa Ernie. He wasn't like Greg or Lionel or Professor Edwards, who was probably, at this very moment, telling one of his unsuspecting students that he'd love to talk to her more about her paper over coffee, and did she know that his apartment was just across campus? The poor girl. She was probably a freshman. Young, naive. Greg had said that Jenny Loudermilk was a freshman. At least, she was until she dropped out of school. She was walking down Broad Street, and in a second, her whole life had changed. She would never again be that girl who walked around without a care in the world. 22 women in Athens would have their lives changed like that this year, and next year, and the year after. Not to mention the ones who had it happen before. It was some kind of horrible that your odds got better every time another woman was raped. Assaulted, attacked, threatened. Like the clock in Times Square counting down the ball every New Year's Eve. Beatrice Oliver, number 22. Jenny Loudermilk, number 21. Mona, no name, number 20. Who would be number 19? Some sloppy, drunk freshman? The girl who was having coffee with Professor Edwards across town?
Deanie Crowder, who had puked out her guts in the bathroom at the bar. Nancy would walk her home. Somebody should walk her home. Julia stumbled over a broken bit of sidewalk. Suddenly, she felt very dizzy. Her stomach roiled. The drink. Maybe the vodka was bad. Or the ginger ale, though she wasn't sure that bad soda was anything but flat. It couldn't make you sick. But she felt sick. She braced herself against the wall and felt a stream of hot liquid come out of her mouth. Julia covered her face with her hands. Something was wrong. She tried to get her bearings. Her parents were at Harry Bissett's, just a few blocks away. They wouldn't be happy to see her like this, but they would be devastated if they found out she'd needed them and didn't reach out. She cut through a side street. Her knees felt wobbly. She leaned against a smelly trash can. Stickers were plastered all over the side. Fish, poison, striker. She tried to read the street sign. Her eyes synthesized the words into white blotches on green. Her parents couldn't be far. She pushed away from the trash can. She tried to focus on the sidewalk ahead of her. Each step was an effort. She had to rest against an old Cadillac to catch her breath. She stared down at tail fins the size of surfboards. Her father loved the Beach Boys. They'd bought him Still Cruisin' for Christmas a few years ago. He was so much happier than when they gave him a book about being old for his last birthday. You look lost. Julia spun around. There was a black van parked in front of the Cadillac. The side door was open. A man was in the shadows. She knew him. She had seen his face before. Maybe several times before. Today? Over the weekend? Downtown? On campus? The information was so close, but she couldn't get her mind to make the connection. I'm sorry, Julia said, because she always apologized for everything. He got out of the van. Julia stepped back, but the sidewalk had turned to sand. He walked toward her. Please, she whispered. Her sisters, her parents, Robin, Nancy, Deanie, Beatrice, Oliver, Jenny, Loudermilk, Mona, no name. In the end, he didn't wrap his hand around her mouth or put a knife to her throat. He just punched her in the face. Julia Carroll, number 19. Author's note. I fudged a bit on the Fish concert date. It was March 1st, but it makes sense those guys would still be there, right? The numbers I quoted from the FBI's Uniform Crime Reporting Program, UCRP, are actually from 1991, the year during which this story is set. As of 2013, the term forcible rape was replaced with rape. And the definition was changed to be more inclusive. Statutory rape and incest data are still not included in this figure. According to the latest FBI Crime Clock data, in America in 2013, a woman was raped every 6.6 minutes. The CDC estimates that roughly 80% of all rapes go unreported. This concludes the reading of Blonde Hair, Blue Eyes by Karen Slaughter. Copyright 2015 by Karen Slaughter Publishing, LLC. This book was read by Kathleen Early. This unabridged recording was published by arrangement with Victoria Sanders and Associates, LLC, and was produced in 2015 by Blackstone Audio, Inc., which holds the copyright. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audio, Inc.
If you would like to obtain a monthly update telling you about new releases, call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-SAY-BOOK.